Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, you're listening to a very special edition of Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Rishi Sunak, Jeremy Hunt, your boys took a hell of a beating. There's only one thing we'll be talking about today and for the next hour, and that will be analysing all the twists and turns of the last 24 hours. The general election is over. We have a new Labour government, the first Labour government of our lifetime for me and Zoe, of our adult lifetimes anyway. Just what can we expect to happen? As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme. Well, let's hear from our new Prime Minister.
I have just returned from Buckingham Palace, where I accepted an invitation from His Majesty the King to form the next government of this great nation. I want to thank the outgoing Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. His achievement as the first British Asian Prime Minister of our country, the extra effort that that will have required, should not be underestimated by anyone. And we pay tribute to that today. And we also recognise the dedication and hard work he brought to his leadership. But now our country has voted decisively for change, for national renewal, and a return of politics to public service. When the gap between the sacrifices made by people and the service they receive from politicians grows this big, it leads to a weariness in the heart of a nation. A draining away of the hope, the spirit, the belief in a better future, that we need to move forward together.
That right there is the first Labour Prime Minister speaking on the steps of Downing Streets for the first time in 14 years, Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Labour have won a landslide and will focus on their victory first. As it stands, we've got two results yet to come. Labour hold 412 seats, just shy of the majority that Tony Blair won in 1997. But interestingly, they've done this with a lower percentage of the vote, just 35%, something we'll get into, I'm sure, throughout the show. But it's the Conservatives that were frankly annihilated at the polls yesterday. They've returned just 121 seats. As it stands, just 24% of the vote, their worst ever result, even worse than the Liberal landslide of 1906, I believe. Reform contributed massively to that. They split the Tory vote, coming second in many seats that would normally be safe Tory seats. They've returned just four MPs, including Nigel Farage, who finally became MP on the eighth attempt. Elsewhere, the Liberal Democrats won big. They've won 71 seats. So Ed Davey clearly resonating with the nation, getting them a record result, bungee jumping around the country and picking up seats. The Greens have won all four of their target seats, and we had Zach Polensky in the studio telling me that he would, and that has proven correct. We'll get into Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland later in the programme, but it was a dismal night for the SNP, who returned just nine MPs, losing 37 seats along the way. But let's start with Labour. They reign supreme across the country. They've won seats in places they never thought they would. Zoe, what's your immediate takeaway?
Despite how a lot of the media have presented this, and the reason the media presented it as almost that Labour have underperformed, and some of that is to do with the fact that polls over the last few weeks were so up and down with how large Labour's vote share could be. This is a fantastic night for Labour. You know, this is a Labour landslide majority. This is a wipeout of Tories. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. Now, Labour is going to be doing a bit of soul searching, as it should. There are a few surprising losses in constituencies to Green MPs and to independent MPs. And I think that tells you something about how the core vote are feeling about some of Labour's policies and Labour's approach to this election. But ultimately, what we have is a really solid, dare I say, supermajority for the Labour Party. And if we just listening to Keir Starmer's speech earlier, I thought it was a really good speech. I really did. I thought it was exact. I thought it was pitched perfectly. It wasn't swimming in joy and self-aggrandizement for Labour's success. It was a, he made it very clear that Labour was there to restore the principle of the government serving the people. And I think that's really hitting at something that people feel, the way people have gone out in their masses to reject the Tory party after 14 years is because the Tory party became a party that no longer served the interests of the public. It served the interests of itself. So I think Starmer pitched that really, really well. There were lots of surprising results across the night as well. A few, as I said, a few surprising losses for the Labour Party. What was really surprising to me, and I was very pleased about, and Ali, I'm sure you felt the same, was when the exit poll came out and it predicted that the Reform Party would get 13 seats, which was then whittled down in reality to 4 seats, thank goodness. But there are still lots of questions from this election about the principle of electoral reform, because we have both Reform and the Greens with quite a large vote share, only picking up 4 seats each. So that's something that's going to come up a lot over the next few weeks, I think. But ultimately, I think we really need to hammer home that this was a great night for Labour.
Yeah, and I think, look, we'll talk about Reform in a bit, but let's talk about Keir Starmer's speech, of which we just had an excerpt there. I heard two things in that speech that came across very, very clearly to me, one of which me and you spoke about yesterday, and it was his talk about taking politics back into public service, taking politics back into a force for good. And that to me was a pitch to the public that he knows how angry the public have been at not just policy, but behavior of politicians and the standard of politics in Westminster. And he wants to do something about that. The second thing I heard was it was very delivery focused. I think Keir knows that he has to act quickly. Perhaps he's even aware that, you know, the national poll vote share wasn't great. It was an incredibly efficient majority for the Labour Party, and they've worked the system very, very well. And I often talk about this with my football team. Whether you win 1-0 or 5-0, you still get 3 points. Nothing changes. And Labour have a super majority. They'll get to govern the country. We'll get to govern the country for the next 5 years. And so ultimately, you know, we can have a discussion in terms of our electoral system about the national vote share. But what really matters is the number of MPs you have. But what was clear to me is this conversation from Labour front benchers in interview after interview talking about change starts now. We have to deliver for the people. It seems like they're clear-eyed about that. Those are the two things I took away. Is that sort of the same sense that you got?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think the other thing to say is it was a typical Keir Starmer speech in that, you know, it doesn't exactly electrify people. It's not things can only get better.
But that's not his style.
No, it's not his style. And, you know, for some reasons, that's why people voted for him. They appreciate Starmer's sort of measured, slightly boring, secure approach to politics. He promised stability and moderation. That's not going to set the country alight. But actually, stability and moderation have been really lacking from the Tory government. You know, you look at Liz Truss's mini budget. That wasn't stability nor moderation. You look at the chaos and sleaze that underpinned Boris Johnson's administration. You look at David Cameron calling a Brexit referendum and then leaving when he didn't get the result he wanted. You know, you look at the wrangling throughout the Brexit years that Theresa May oversaw. Stability and moderation did not define the Tory era. And actually, if you speak to the average voter on the street, what they want a political system that they don't have to think about. They don't want to have to know who the name of the Chancellor is. They don't have to want to know the name of the Home Secretary or the Housing Minister or, you know, the Education Secretary, because politics for many people should just be happening in the background and should just be providing that safety net, improving their lives and making sure the country's running and, you know, the trains are running on time and they can get a GP appointment. Yeah. And it hasn't been like that. And that, you know, we've lost in this country such a basic lack of what the government should be doing. And I think that's why Keir Starmer pitched that speech well. The problem is trust is really broken. So it's going to be a mountain for him to climb to actually prove that a Labour government can restore that.
Yeah, look, I could not agree with you more. In fact, I think the number one thing I learnt when standing for Parliament in 2019 and the conversations I had with people was again and again, people said, listen, I have to wake up in the morning. I have to dress and feed the kids. I have to take them to school. Then I and my partner go to work and we got to do everything at work. Then on the way home, we do the shopping, pick up the kids, make dinner. And then we have maybe an hour to like watch some TV and go to bed and we'll all start again. We don't have time to think about the transport system. We don't have time or the energy or the capacity to think about defense or housing or the NHS. We just expect you guys to make these things work for us. And I think the large rejection of the Conservative Party is people have felt that burden in their own home that these things just aren't working. They can't get appointments at the GPs. The trains never run on time and the TfL is basically bankrupt. And worries around defense with the war in Ukraine, COVID, dodgy contracts and all those things. And so I think Sir Keir is going to be facing away from his own personal mandate and popularity or unpopularity, away from the national vote of Labour, away from all of that stuff. I think what he's facing is a general distrust, like you say, and dissatisfaction with politics. And that's quite a big hurdle to overcome when people think you're all the same, you're all corrupt, you're all crooked. And to convince them that, again, politics can be a force for good and in service of working people, I think, is going to be challenging. My question for you is, we now have a Labour government for the first time in 14 years. I'm looking at some of the shadow, not the shadow, you see, I'm doing it again. Some of the cabinet appointments now, this is someone who's lost many an election that instinctually just said shadow cabinet. But I'm looking at some of the cabinet appointments now. No real big surprises. Rachel Reeves makes history by becoming the first woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer. David Lammy holds his position as Foreign Secretary. Shabana Mahmood, the first senior Muslim woman to hold a cabinet post since Saida Warsi. She becomes Justice Secretary. First 100 days, what do you think Sir Keir needs to tackle?
The big thing is going to be getting Britain building. I know that's going to be a big priority for this Labour government straight away. They want to get their planning reforms through as quickly as possible. They want to get spades in the ground, by the end of the year. They want to get councils being able to buy land quickly. Excuse me. So that house building can begin, and not just house building, building other bits of infrastructure as well. You know, we talk about house building. House building is vitally important, but you need to make sure that houses have all the other structure in place around them. So they need schools, they need hospitals, they need GP surgeries, they need, you know, we even need prisons and things like that. So absolutely, this country has had a dearth of building over the past decade, and really Keir Starmer's growth agenda just cannot happen if Britain's not building. So planning reform is going to be a really kind of major priority. The other thing I think that's going to be pretty big for Labour is obviously going to be their kind of workers' rights stuff. Am I right in thinking Keir Starmer has to head to NATO fairly soon, maybe in the next few weeks?
He does, yes.
So he's going to have to kind of he's going to have to make a stance as the new prime minister of the country and, you know, really kind of shore up those foreign alliances at a time where geopolitics is quite tense. And just sort of bringing in those new GP and NHS appointments, I think a real big priority will be kind of severing that industrial action that is happening with the junior doctors and trying to get the NHS slowly moving again and cutting through that backlog. So I would imagine those would be the priorities: NHS building and making his kind of statesman entrance at NATO.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just got some breaking news. South Basildon has gone to Reform after a number of recounts. Reform has taken South Basildon and they now hold 5 MPs, again, way short of the 13 that was initially predicted by the exit polls. We should say exit polls do struggle with smaller parties, have always done so, because the way exit polls work is they look at swings in key constituencies, and therefore it's very, very difficult to look at smaller parties. We're going to talk about Reform a little bit later on the show. I do want to just stay on Labour a little while longer. Do you think, Zoe, I mean, we're looking at a super majority here. 412, a little shy of the 1997 majority that Tony Blair has. Does that give Sir Keir Starmer a little bit more room to be a little bit more radical, maybe a little bit bolder, or does the size of the majority not really matter? He's looking to the country and not to Westminster.
No, I think it does matter. I think, you know, if you want to push through big things like planning reform, which, you know, that actually was undid Sunak very, very quickly. He had a raft of planning reforms, him and Michael Gove, who was formerly housing secretary. And immediately the Tories rebelled against it. And he had to climb down very, very quickly and U-turn on compulsory targets for councils for houses in those areas. And that immediately undid his authority in the party. And very quickly after that, the era of Sunak being a weak prime minister was ushered in because he just couldn't stand up to his party on this. Keir Starmer is in a really strong position. He has this big sweeping majority. He has this mandate from the public. He can absolutely now push through something like planning reform, which is in some ways controversial for some constituencies. There are lots of people. The public is actually pretty evenly split on whether they are sort of NIMBYs or YIMBYs, you know, whether they want control over what's built in their local area. So it can be quite hard to talk about planning reforms because some people in local councils see that as actually taking power out of local authorities.
Can I just not
give them a say?
Can I just ask you on that? Because there's been some spatterings that I have heard, particularly in Labour circles, that given that Labour has swept so many of the southern seats where these planning reforms are quite controversial, given the Greenbelt areas and the green areas, that there might be some internal pushback of that. But given the size of the majority, will Keir care?
I mean, there is absolutely going to be pushback. You know, if this was easy, it would have been done.
But it'll come from within the Labour Party. That's the difference now.
Yeah. The thing is, they've got 5 years now, mm-hmm. And they've got that mandate. You know, they've got 5 years to make their case, to push through on popular decisions, and hope that in 5 years they've paid off, so that the electorate give them another shot at government.
Yeah. Do you think on that? Do you think he can? Do you think on some of these things he can take his time, knowing he's got 5 years, or does he have to move quickly?
So on things like planning reform, where you're really trying to like win half the room round and really make the case for why this is so important for growing the economy. And you have to remember, none of this is going to happen overnight. Firstly, you have to reform the planning system, which is incredibly archaic. Then you have to get it through. Then you have to build stuff. That takes time. So he absolutely needs to start now on that. You know, there's no time like the present. On other stuff, you can take a bit more time. So, for example, on the employment rights bill, or the New Deal for workers, they are kind of slightly kicking that into the long grass with consultations. I think they still want to get it done in the first 100 days, or at least that's what Bloomberg were reporting this morning. But, you know, that is kind of something that they can take a bit more time with, because it's not, as you say, there aren't these kind of pockets of rebellion that you could see brewing. But I think Labour know that their support is very, very broad, but shallow and brittle. You know, it's we've seen that it's really widely dispersed, and a lot of people lent Labour their vote because they were disappointed with the Tories and might not necessarily do so the next time. So any of these big things that Keir Starmer is banking on to fundamentally change the country, he needs to get through as soon as possible, so that in 5 years' time, when the country goes to the polls again, he can point to tangible change. And that was something Sunak couldn't do.
Yeah, and just quickly on the NHS, we've got Wes Streeting returning or entering as the health secretary. How quickly do they need to move on tackling these NHS waiting times? To a certain extent, a lot of it is out of their hands. There is a huge backlog following COVID, so there's a lot that they can do, but it's a difficult situation. So how quickly do you think they need to move on that? Because surprisingly enough, some of the research and polling I'm seeing coming out, it's very early on, was that actually the NHS seemed to be top of the agenda for people who are voting. I think the majority of people said it was one of the main reasons why they didn't vote Conservative this time.
Mm-hmm. NHS is always number one or number two in the majority of voters' priorities, always has been. And absolutely, the Conservatives are not trust on the NHS. We've also got a big portion of Lib Dem MPs coming in. The Lib Dems have had their best night, I think, ever. Am I right in thinking it's about 71 MPs that the Lib Dems have
yes,
got?
Yes, yeah, it is. I think it's their best, the best result in modern politics.
Yeah. And they stood on a platform of renewal for the NHS and social care. So it's going to be a big caucus of MPs pushing Labour on the NHS, pushing them to kind of future-proof it and try and get it back on its feet. The other thing to say is Wes Streeting has said on a number of occasions that day one, he is going to get on the phone to the BMA, the British Medical Association, and try and stop those junior doctor strikes as soon as possible. So it'll be really interesting to see. That would be, if he could do that, that would be a quick, easy win for Labour. Yeah. I say easy, it probably won't be easy, but yeah. It will be a quick win for Labour that straight away they can say, look, we did what the Conservatives took years to do.
Yeah.
We, you know, ended this strike deadlock.
It will be challenging, though, because we did hear a spokesperson for the junior doctors say they were absolutely willing to strike under a Labour government. And so it'll be a challenge, but one that Wes seems keen to meet. More on this historic result, this election result, where we'll discuss just what went wrong for the Tories and the surge in reform. It's 5:20.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me now, I have Claire Seal, who is a content creator and author.
You know, I think there's loads of shame when it comes to money and financial difficulty, but I honestly think that shame is really a symptom of the judgment that exists in society. I don't think that people are feeling ashamed for the sake of it. I think they're feeling ashamed because you can't really sort of open your phone or open a newspaper without seeing these huge judgments piled on people who've made mistakes with money. And I think it's acceptable for people to slag you off about being bad with money in a way that it might not be for like other mistakes that you might make.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Let's bring in Tobias Elwood, former Defence Minister.
Rishi Sunak has done well to pivot us back, taken us into far calmer political waters.
Has he taken you back into calmer political waters? I mean, you're on track, according to some of the polls, to the largest wipeout in years and, you know, may never return from it. I mean, how has he taken you back into calmer political waters?
We've just seen inflation go down to 2%. Confidence in business is returning.
But is that down to Rishi Sunak?
You've got to let me finish the question. You keep asking me a question and then throwing another question in.
I'm just curious to know, is inflation down to Rishi Sunak?
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
I have this stunning Steph Williams with me now, founder of the WeGlow app. I did turf games on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And it was horrible. It was horrible. But it was so fun. But it was like savage, right? Yeah. But I wasn't the best in the room and I hate that. And I was like, oh, God, I haven't trained like well enough for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I don't normally think I am. But then when I was there, I was like, this is so annoying because... Yeah. And then I was like, why do I actually need to be good at this though? Yeah. Like, can I not just do it for fun?
But also, it's like when I've done like casts and stuff before and the blokes were like, lift that heavier weight. And I'm like, no, like I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to lift the heavier weight. Like, I know what I'm capable of. I know what works for my body.
Yeah.
And I think it's just kind of, like, I know what makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you're working out to feel good, you're going to look good.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
It is 5:23. Well, some of the Tories might be blaming Starmer for their losses, but this man definitely had his part to play.
The results show there is absolutely no enthusiasm for Starmer's Labour whatsoever. And it was interesting to watch Starmer speak outside Number 10, his first Prime Ministerial address, having been to see the King. And you know, in the course of that speech, he looked down at his notes over 150 times. Once every 2.8 seconds... Now, I don't think these people with me need a script because they know what they believe in. And when it comes to providing the voice of opposition, well, we may be too few in number to necessarily be thought of as the opposition in the House of Commons. But let me promise you something. We are going to be the opposition around the country.
What the fuck was that? Apparently, Keir Starmer looks at his notes too often, Zoe. Well... That was Nigel Farage. the new Reform MP. At the eighth time of trying, he's become a Member of Parliament for Clacton, speaking earlier. Let's get straight into it, Zoe. Reform have taken a significant portion of the Tory vote. They are, by and large, the reason the election results have gone the way they have gone and so poorly for Rishi Sunak. They've got over 4 million votes. They've come second in nearly 100 seats, taken 4 MPs. How do you reflect on Reform's performance?
Well, I think it's very clear that there is a portion of the population who have voted Reform, in part because they're frustrated with the Tories and it was a protest vote. But some people have voted it because they like Nigel Farage and they like the stuff the party is saying. I think there's what annoyed me was there was a lot of focus on Reform last night. And you understand why. They have clearly divided the Conservative Party to the point where they have directly, in some ways, led to them no longer being in government. So you understand that focus. But the Green Party received the same number, roughly the same number of votes, and now not the same number of seats because Reform literally in the last 10 minutes just took another seat. But, you know, the Greens got 4 seats and Reform got 5. It's been far less attention paid to the Greens and that kind of feeling, the progressive vote and the feeling of, you know, the Greens now representing a portion of the public.
Yeah.
And so I find that quite frustrating. Listening to Nigel Farage's speech, I mean, can we just talk about that? What is wrong with having a speech and looking down at your notes and making sure you're on record? This is the biggest speech of Keir Starmer's political career. It's absolutely important that he gets the tone right. This is something that he will be remembered by. He has to pitch the party to all the voters who have lent Labour their vote and all the voters who didn't vote for Labour. Mm-hmm. And who are disappointed. He has to show that he's going to unite the country and work in their best interest.
But Zoe, I think there was something in that because I noticed it immediately as we got the results from Clacton and Nigel Farage gave his victory speech from the stage. He pivoted immediately to Labour voters and he said, we're coming for Labour now. And in this attack of Keir Starmer, it seems like he thinks he's gained the maximum number of votes he's going to from the Conservative Party and he's now pivoting to Labour voters, of which the 100 seats I said that they came second in, almost all of them were Labour. So it seems like that's his priority now, go after Labour votes.
So, you know, it's absolutely the case that in a lot of those Red Wall constituencies, a lot of those areas where Reform made gains, they were taking away the 2019 Conservative vote. There's still the Labour vote there. The question as to whether Reform is actually converting Labour, 2019 Labour voters and 2024 Labour voters is a different one. And actually, not that long ago, I interviewed Professor John Curtis about this because Richard Tice and Nigel Farage had both been saying, we're going to park our tanks on Labour's lawn next. You know, we're going to go after Labour voters. And Sir John Curtis made the point that actually, it's going to be quite hard for Reform to go after Labour voters because they don't share the same sort of values as 2019 Conservative voters. They tend to be much friendlier towards the EU, for example. They tend to be slightly more progressive. One of the points that Reform could possibly exploit going forward, and this is going to be something that Labour have to tackle really carefully. Well, A, there's immigration, because that is a concern for lots of voters, including Labour voters.
And we've got a summer in which we expect small boat arrivals to rise, as they do every summer, and Farage is going to go nuts about that.
Absolutely. The other thing is the green transition, because this is going to be a fairly big part of Labour's offering. They didn't speak about it much during the general election, precisely because it is controversial and it has been used by the right. They have to ensure that the green transition is done in a way that it's not costing people personally, because that's exactly the sort of thing Reform would zero in on. They would say Labour are chasing the green stuff for political reasons and it's going to cost you money. And that is something that I imagine Nigel Farage and Reform are going to exploit and hold Labour's feet to the fire over. I would say green stuff and immigration, those are the two points where they might be hoping to convert some votes. But actually, I think they might hit a ceiling with this because, as I said before, Labour voters tend to be more progressive and they tend to be more amenable to the European Union. And I don't think that's going to necessarily go away. I think Starmer is going to move slightly closer to the European Union. And as a result, we're going to see some of these things, like the small votes crisis, like the economy, like our trade deals, all improve, because realistically Brexit did a lot of damage, and to undo that damage you do need a better relationship with the EU.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about you mentioned it briefly, but I do want to touch on it. All of the noise yesterday or overnight has been on reform, but the Green Party did get equal number of votes. Do you think there's a little bit of hysteria around Nigel Farage and he gets more coverage than he should? A little bit Trumpian. I mean, I remember largely because I campaigned in the campaign in America, but after Trump got elected, a lot of the country looked to the media and said, you made this happen because you gave this man more coverage than he deserved. Is Farage a smaller version of that? He gets more coverage than he deserves?
I would say so. I mean, he's a provocateur and people like him. He's populist, so the media cover him. The thing is, when you have a figure like that, you can't not give them attention, media attention, because they will say, why is the mainstream media not covering me? This is a conspiracy. And it's sort of, you know, we saw it during the general election campaign when he was insisting on being a part of the Sunak-Starmer debate. He said Reform's in the running. We're the third largest party. We should be given airtime. And, you know, that sort of stuff really picks up. So the media is in a difficult position where they're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah.
But it was frustrating to see all this attention paid to Reform last night and the exit poll predicting 13 seats, which was then whittled down now finally to 5.
Yeah.
When actually the Greens have made quite substantial gains, but nobody really cares about that.
Yeah, they got the highest vote share. We're going to talk about the Greens in a moment. But given that Reform have been largely responsible for an annihilation of Tory MPs across the country, let's talk a little bit about what we expect the Tory leadership race to look like. Rishi Sunak has now resigned. The voices that we're hearing and the names that we're hearing that might come up in this leadership election that we expect will run over the summer and into conference season is the likes of Suella Braverman, Kemi Badenoch, people like Tom Tugendhat, and others. Zoe, what do you expect this Tory leadership race to look like? And is there a risk of a slight overreaction, as some in the Tory front bench, or previously on the Tory front bench, had said, of overreacting to the Reform vote and pivoting hard to the right?
I think there's definitely going to be a fight over what the Conservative Party does next. And I would be very afraid of the number of right-wing voices in the party who are going to make the case for either joining forces with Reform or just putting up a direct fight with Reform and taking all their policies on.
Could we also see some defections, maybe?
I don't know. I don't know about that, because the Conservatives did slightly better than worst case scenario. And, you know, it would kind of like be defecting to the losing party in many ways, because they still have far more seats and far more power and far more party infrastructure and far more donors and things like that than Reform do. But I do think there'll be some backroom deals. And, you know, the prospect of Reform and the Conservatives, or an offshoot of the Conservatives joining forces, is a real one. In terms of Tory leaderships, I mean, Priti Patel, for me, seems like quite an obvious contender. She's a Boris Johnson continuity candidate. She was the architect of the Rwanda plan.
I just felt a shiver down my spine. But carry
I know.
On. But carry
on. I know.
I thought we'd got rid of her, but okay. Here we go again.
Yeah, so, you know, Priti Patel, that's a possibility. I think the right might win the conversation. I think that would be wrong. Daryl Morris, who is a presenter on Times Radio and a brilliant presenter on Times Radio, I have to say, made this point. I won't steal it because it's not mine. But he said in 2015, UKIP won 3.8 million votes. That was 12.6% of the popular vote. Reform, this time round in 2024, won 4 million votes, 14.3%. He said the media narrative could easily be, why hasn't the hard right made more progress in the last 10 years? But it hasn't. I mean, this is a really good point. You know, actually, materially, our circumstances are a lot worse than in 2015. We're poorer, public services are in more dire straits, everything's got much, much worse. Yet the far right actually haven't made that many gains.
Yeah, that's remarkable. They've stood still.
Yeah, they've stood still. So it would be wrong to decide that the wind is blowing towards the right, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a Labour landslide. Clearly, the public are in the centre.
That's an amazing piece of analysis. And actually, you mentioned it to me before we came on air, and it's completely shifted the way I look at things now. Mm. Because it's taken me from thinking there is momentum behind their sales to thinking, no, all that's happened here is UKIP have redefined themselves or rebranded themselves and a little bit better organized and with a little bit more money. But actually, in terms of the far right vote across this country, it's not gone up at all. And really, it should have, because you're right, materially, we're much poorer. Public services are in a much worse place. There is much less trust in mainstream parties and mainstream politicians. This country, 58% voted for the two mainstream parties. That's the lowest in modern history for the two mainstream parties. And so the scene was set for the far right to make massive gains. And they haven't. They've stood still.
Mm. And can I make two more quick points about this reform surge and two points of optimism that I have that I could definitely be wrong about? The first is bringing Nigel Farage into the establishment, I think, might neutralise him slightly. He's now going to have to be a serving MP for the people of Clacton. One of the reasons the people of Clacton have voted for Nigel Farage is because materially they are very badly off. There's a lot of disillusionment, a lot of disenfranchisement, and it's a deprived area. If Nigel Farage doesn't deliver positive change for the people of Clacton, which I suspect he won't, because Reform don't have that much influence in the House of Commons. Nigel Farage is a populist leader. He cares a lot about himself. I don't know how much he cares about the people of Clacton. They might not be very forgiving in 5 years' time. So, you know, him being inside the House of Commons takes away some of his anti-establishment personality. So I think, you know, you could potentially see a slight neutering of Farage in some ways. The other thing I was going to say is Starmer is definitely going to have to move closer to France and Europe over the next few years to deal with some of the issues that we spoke about earlier. We know that the right is on the resurgence in Europe. Would Starmer, actually, Ali, I would like to know what you think. Starmer working with someone like Marie Le Pen, does that not kind of bring the conversation to reform? If they say everybody's ignoring the right, but then the Prime Minister can say, actually, I work with the right on issues like small boats. Mm-hmm. Does that not kind of, you know, if then they still criticise that the government's approach, to some extent they're criticising the people they are aligned with in Europe.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Look, I think, first of all, within the Labour Party, that will be hugely controversial, and there'll be a huge battle on Starmer's hand mm-hmm. to work with someone like Marine Le Pen, who I believe is an out-and-out fascist. That doesn't mean that he won't do it, because they've made very strong indications to people like Donald Trump that, you know, it's now a British government, and they're going to have to work with whoever's in power across the world. So I think Starmer will have some internal issues there. My big worry, actually, we've spoken about Tory reactions to reform that may be overblown given the analysis that we've just given. I worry that the Labour Party may overreact to reform and Nigel Farage in Parliament, given that we expect small boats to rise. And I fear that we may give space to Farage. We may indulge him a little bit too long. And I always say this about the right and the far right. When we on the centre-left and the left, when we fight battles on their terrain, we lose. Because we cannot allow Nigel Farage to paint the box within which we have the debate on immigration, because we will lose to him. It's that old saying of you can't wrestle a pig, because it'll drag you into the mud and beat you on experience. So I think we have to differentiate ourselves. That doesn't mean not tackling the issue, but I do think it means differentiating ourselves. I worry that if Starmer says, listen, I'm working with the likes of Marine Le Pen to as a way to kind of to stave off the reform narrative and arguments, we may end up allowing Farage to set the scene in which we have this immigration debate, of which we will lose. I think we in the Labour Party have to seriously learn the lessons of Macron in France, because Marine Le Pen and the far right are on a massive sort of surge in France. We've seen that they came first in the recent parliamentary elections, and I think we have to take the fight to them very, very quickly. Although there is a difference, because as we've just analysed in the last 10 years, the far right in this country haven't made the progress that Le Pen and that the far right in France have made. So there's an argument that it's very different. Actually, there's an argument to say the progressives on the left have made a far bigger surge in the UK than the far right have had. Looking at the Green vote, it's gone from, I think, 800,000 to nearly 2 and a bit million. We've seen independents rise in votes. So I worry, as much as we may be warning the Conservative Party leadership not to pander to reform in their leadership elections, I would also make similar warnings to my own party, Labour, and particularly those who worry about Nigel Farage this summer, to look at Macron in France and be wary of that. Much more on these election results next, where we'll be discussing the other parties in the UK who did well and who did not do well. We're looking to you, the Scottish National Party. The time is 5:40.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me now, I have Claire Seal, who is a content creator and author.
You know, I think there's loads of shame when it comes to money and financial difficulty, but I honestly think that that shame is really a symptom of the judgment that exists in society. I don't think that people are feeling ashamed for the sake of it. I think they're feeling ashamed because you can't really sort of open your phone or open a newspaper without seeing these huge judgments piled on people who've made mistakes with money. And I think it's acceptable for people to slag you off about being bad with money in a way that it might not be for like other mistakes that you might make.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Let's bring in Tobias Elwood, former Defence Minister.
Rishi Sunak has done well to pivot us back, taken us into far calmer political waters.
Has he taken you back into calmer political waters? I mean, you're on track, according to some of the polls, to the largest wipeout in years and, you know, may never return from it. I mean, how has he taken you back into calmer political waters?
We've just seen inflation go down to 2%. Confidence in business is returning.
But is that down to Rishi Sunak?
You've got to let me finish the question. You keep asking me a question and then throwing another question in.
Oh, I'm just curious to know, is inflation down to Rishi Sunak?
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
I have this stunning Steph Williams with me now, founder of the We Glow app. I did turf games on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And it was horrible. It was horrible. But it was so fun. But it was like savage, right? Yeah. But I wasn't the best in the room and I hate that. And I was like, oh God, I haven't trained like well enough for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I don't normally think I am. But then when I was there, I was like, this is so annoying because. Yeah. And then I was like, why do I actually need to be good at this though? Yeah. Like, can I not just do it for fun?
But also, it's like when I've done like casting stuff before and the blokes were like, lift that heavier weight. And I'm like, no, like, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to lift the heavier weight. Like, I know what I'm capable of. I know what works for my body.
Yeah.
And I think it's just kind of, like, I know what makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you're working out to feel good, you're going to look good.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored. It is 5:42. Now let's talk about the other parties across the UK who are the winners and losers, particularly in Scotland. Zoe, the SNP have fallen to historic lows. Labour have regained their grip on Scotland. Where does this put the independence debate and how far does it push it back?
I think it was already pushed quite far back, to be honest. The SNP have been struggling on a couple of fronts. The first is the internal party chaos they've been dealing with as they are under investigation for their party finances. The second is that the independence mandate has just taken a hit again and again. And without independence, the party is actually very divided. Mm-hmm. You have sort of much more kind of conservative nationalist wing of the SNP. And then you have a much more progressive wing of the SNP. And we saw how they fell out over the gender recognition bill stuff not that long ago. And yeah. I think that really is a sign of things to come.
I think like Alex Salmond made that point on BBC. He said that the mistake that the SNP made was they tried to fight this election on austerity rather than independence.
I mean, I disagree because the fact is that everybody across the UK is dealing with the fallout of 14 years of Conservative rule, most of which is felt through their own purses and wallets and public services. And while there is a lot of people in Scotland who care about independence and want independence, ultimately, people's priorities always tend to be how well off they feel and how well their public services are functioning. And I think there was just a feeling, as there was throughout the rest of the UK, that it was time to get the Tories out. So people were always going to put independence aside for this general election, I think. But the reason that left the SNP so exposed is because they're not very coherent on other issues. What really brought them together was independence. And, you know, this was an election that wasn't about that and was never going to be.
Yeah, and that seemed to be what John Sweeney said in his interview. They said, listen, we've just been swept aside by this change narrative. And Scottish voters know that in order to rid the country of Tories, they have to vote in Labour MPs. And that seems to have been what's happened. How important is it for Anna Sawar and the Scottish Labour Party to keep control of Scotland now and keep their grip of Scottish politics? Because it seems to be that Labour governments often run right through Scotland.
Yeah, so I mean, the path to Labour victory is often through Scotland, and we've seen that very much in this case as well. The big thing I think that might be a point of contention for Labour in Scotland is again the green stuff, which I keep calling it because I can't think of a better term for it because it's lots of different policies all looped in together. Mm-hmm. There is a tension, and we've seen it a little bit with the unions as well, between Labour's New Deal for workers, protecting workers' rights, protecting industry, particularly protecting the oil and, you know, workers in the oil and gas industries, and the green transition. And although it can be done, it absolutely can be done, that those workers are moving into greener industries, it's a difficult, complex thing, and it takes a lot of leadership and convincing and bringing the unions along with you. And the reason Scotland is particularly exposed to that is because Scotland's economy is very heavily reliant on oil and gas. So that could be a point of contention. And I think that is something that the SNP could potentially exploit if they felt that Scotland was in some way being sold down the river for Labour's green agenda or it wasn't being listened to. You could imagine that that's something the SNP would pick up. But again, that sort of could be an issue for the SNP itself because it is split along progressive lines. And there are many within the SNP who would really value the green transition and are probably feeling quite unsure about how to sort of rectify it with the fact that Scotland's economy is quite heavily reliant on oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the fact that Scotland is quite politically chaotic in that sense has helped Labour and might continue to help Labour. But absolutely, when independence is still, you know, the drive for independence is still there with a lot of Scottish people, Keir Starmer is going to have to do a lot to make Scotland feel valued and listened to from Westminster, because for a long time, the SNP have said that Scotland does not feel like Westminster governs in its interests.
Yeah, and let's talk about the Green Party now, because they do deserve some recognition. They have quadrupled the number of seats in the Commons to 4, which was their goal when we had Zach Polensky on the show. He said the best case scenario for the Greens, the best case realistic scenario for the Greens was 4 MPs, which they have elected across the country, including defeating Labour's Thangam Debonair in Bristol by a majority of 10,000. They've got a national vote now of over 2 million. That's up from 800,000. They have made massive strides for them around the country. As Keir Starmer seemingly has dragged the Labour Party closer to the centre, how much space is there for the Greens to make some serious gains over the next 5 to 10 years and establish themselves as a serious opposition party? Or is this their ceiling?
It's hard to say.
But there's definitely an opportunity for them here, right? Because what they will see, they will see themselves as to the left of Starmer for sure. They know that there's a large percentage of the Labour vote which is disillusioned with the move to the centre. So while Labour has gained a lot of mainstream votes and been able to walk into government, they have, in the nicest possible way, pissed off a lot of people on the left. Surely that, on top of the anger over Gaza, as well as what has been clearly a successful election period for them, will make Greens feel like they can make some serious gains.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of it depends on the sort of political context as well, I think. So if Starmer is able to achieve some quite consequential things, you can imagine that support being shored up. Mm-hmm. If, however, he's not, and, you know, the situation in Gaza continues, worsens, we see more, you know, more incursions from Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, that could raise the profile of those kind of issues that are very difficult for Labour.
Well, look, the Greens have come second in, I think what I'm looking at here is 41 seats. That's very impressive. 2 million votes. They've come second in places like Bristol East, Huddersfield, Sheffield Central, Bristol, Hackney, Leeds, Manchester. So their support is quite wide scale throughout the country. I think you're right. Look, if the Starmer administration is quite successful quite quickly, then they may find some difficulty in some of that left vote naturally coming back to the Labour Party. But if they're not, then surely the Greens can see themselves as being the left-wing alternative to the Labour Party.
I think that's true. I think a lot of it depends on, you know, just how successful the Labour project is. The thing to note, though, is that without electoral reform,
they're very limited, aren't they?
It's very, very hard for the Greens to achieve substantial seats.
And let's talk about that electoral reform, if you will. Look, we've given Labour massive plaudits. We've spoken for, I think, 20 minutes about their successes, how efficient they've been in this election. So I'm not taking anything away from that. But I feel like I have to say it when we've won, when my team have won. Otherwise, when I say it when we lose, it sounds kind of like the losing team complaining about the referee. So I have to say it now as someone who thinks that this system is flawed. The Labour Party have achieved 2/3 of the parliamentary seats on 1/3 of the votes. I think we've gained something like 67% of MPs with 34-35% of the vote. Reform UK have 4 MPs on 4.5 million votes. The Green Party have 4 MPs on over 2 million votes, whereas Labour have 411 MPs on 9 million votes. There is a serious problem with this system, I think, you know, and there is a weird coalition building of Nigel Farage, Ed Davey, Jeremy Corbyn and others, all of whom are saying this is broken. I think if we had any sort of lay voter in this studio right now, we said to them, do you think it's democratic? Do you think it's right that any party will get 2/3 of the majority on 1/3 of the vote? And given turnout, by the way, 1 in 5 people in this country have voted Labour, and now Labour have a supermajority in Parliament. I'm very pleased at that supermajority. I'm glad we've won the election. I'm glad we've got the opportunity to change the country. But the electoral system is broken. I don't know how anyone can deny that now, right?
Yeah. But the problem is, for people like us, we're all, you know, we're all in favour of electoral reform
when we went.
Until
we went
picking up big shares of the vote.
But I used to hold this position, Zoe, right? I used to say, we can't have PR because look at the rise of the far right. Look at the rise of fascists. Mm-hmm. We can't allow fascists to come into our parliament. The reality is we cannot build a democratic system with not liking the result as part of our thinking. We can't say, you know, we're going to build a democratic system, but these guys might win. There might be a will for them in the country to hold seats, and therefore we're going to hold them back.
And keeping them out builds momentum and anger for their people's voices not being represented properly. And, you know, that's something we've seen across the red wall at this election, that people are frustrated that their interests are not being represented.
Turnout. This is the lowest turnout we've had in modern times. The closest, I think, was 2005, maybe, where we got 60-something percent. This is the lowest turnout since the war, I believe, in voters. Something is seriously broken. The question is, will anything really change? Because we need one of the two major parties to shift on it, and they won't because they continue to succeed in the system.
There is a push from within the Labour Party for electoral reform,
The majority of Labour Party members support PR. We voted on it at conference and it went through massively. But it's not reflected in the parliamentary Labour Party for sure.
I think, again, a lot of this is going to depend on how successful Labour is. Mm-hmm. If you know, Labour achieve a lot and do a lot and everybody is happier, better off, public services are functioning better, you can imagine a situation where Labour would be more amenable to suggest to doing things like that, because, like, why not? They've got a good track record. Their track record will speak for itself. I mean, that's a very optimistic perspective, but the problem is when you're hanging on by a shoestring and when your support is very, very broad and very, very shallow, mm-hmm. like it is in this election, why would you essentially, it's like turkeys voting for Christmas, why would you essentially give yeah. away your shot at a majority?
Yeah,
so Labour have to shore up their reputation and their legacy before they make the case for PR.
And I suspect this is something we're going to be speaking more about, because Nigel Farage has made it a case for him, particularly in his speech, since he's won. Last story I want to talk about, Zoe, is Labour have had historic gains all over the country, but have had some shocks around the country as well. Jonathan Ashworth, a major frontbencher, has lost his seat in Leicester to a Muslim independent. Independents on pro-Gaza platforms have won in Blackburn. They've defeated Khalid Mahmood in Birmingham Perry Bar. Jeremy Corbyn won his seat on in Islington, talking quite frequently about Gaza. And the early data suggests that Labour have hemorrhaged Muslim votes around the country. Bearing in mind, Muslims are amongst the most, have been historically amongst the most loyal Labour voters anywhere in the country. It looks like that vote has directly been cut in half. Not only did we lose five independent campaigns around the country, but the loss of Fazer Shaheen in Chingford, Ian Duncan Smith was able to win, Shabana Mahmood, majority was cut, Rashnara Ali's majority was cut, Wes Streeting was a whisker away from losing his seat. So I think it's no longer the question of polls now, but tangible votes. There is Muslim indignation and pure anger at the Labour Party. We saw that in the ballot box. Independents unseating major frontbench MPs. I don't remember who it was, but someone warned about this 6 or 7 months ago. Very good looking chap, is a member of the Labour Party. Nobody listened. How dangerous do you think this will be? And I guess my actual question, forget about that, that was a crap question. This is my real question, right? Labour have won a super majority. Do you think they'll be thinking hard politically in that, well, we don't need those votes, right? We've been able to win without Muslims. They are no longer part of our electoral coalition. Or will they be, in my view, a little bit smarter and say, we need to win these votes back, because one day we may not have a supermajority and we can't be affording to lose Birmingham and Blackburn and East London, for example.
I think they will be worried, because not only did we see Jonathan Ashworth lose his seat, which was a shock and nobody really saw coming, but Wes Streeting and Jess Phillips were clinging on by their fingernails after challenges from independent candidates. And Wes Streeting, particularly, is Keir Starmer's boy. You know, he is tipped to be so many ways.
Tipped to be the next leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah, he's the heir to Starmer. And imagine if he'd lost his seat, the soul searching the Labour Party would be forced to do. They would be unwise not to look at that. And the thing that I think is really key here is, now Streeting and Phillips and other MPs who've faced a similar challenge will be getting lots of pressure from constituents over the party's approach mm-hmm. to Gaza. And now, you know, because Starmer is prime minister, it matters far more, you know, it really does, because this is actual foreign policy that they are creating.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's no longer on the sidelines.
The push will be from inside Starmer's own, you know, closest team now. So I'm hopeful they take this more seriously, because, as you say, Ali, this is their core vote, and you can only neglect your core vote for so long.
Yeah, and I think that message has been loud and clear. Well, this has been an election result that is seismic, a Labour government for the first time in 14 years. But there are so many subplots to this election, from the Green surge, the Reform surge, SNP falling flat, the Muslim vote having a real impact in seats, Sinn Féin historic in Northern Ireland, which we've not been able to talk about, but I'm sure we'll be able to pick up in future episodes. And we're going to keep an eye on this historic Labour government over this summer, looking at some of the key stories coming out, the Conservative leadership election, who's likely to win. Zoe has mentioned Priti Patel, and now I won't be able to sleep at least for 6 months. But we're going to see how that unpans, and we'll definitely have them on the show. Zoe, how many, before we end the show, give us an indication. How little sleep have you had over the last 24 hours?
I've had I had 2 hours between about 4 and 6 a.m. and then I've just had about an hour and a half.
There you go. Well, I was 8 till 10:30, so let's both go get some sleep, not before I catch the Portugal-France game. Thank you so much, Zoe, for joining us on such little sleep. That's it from Politics Uncensored. We'll be back at 5 p.m. next Thursday to run you through Labour's first week in power. It's an exciting time for British politics. You can stay up to date with the show by following Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK. Where can we find you, Zoe?
Yeah, sorry, and me, Zoe Grunewald, at Zoe underscore Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at foobarradio.com. Thank you for listening. I'm going to try that again. See you all again next Thursday.